Hello and welcome to Tau Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. We have a great mix coming at you for this morning's show. Claudio Sant, professor in American history, is in conversation with Colette LaBeouf. His most recent book, Unworthy Republic, was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Then, Jack Lorraine and Jasmine Freedom share their thoughtful takes on a new documentary about M.C. Escher, the Dutch graphic artist known for his mathematically inspired woodcuts and lithographs. And then, Elise Morion brings us news from the art world. Today's edition is about filmmakers and studios gearing up for both the Golden Globes and Academy Awards. First up, a conversation with the historian Claudio Sant. He's the associate director of the Institute of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia. He has written four books, including West of the Revolution in 2014, Black, White, and Indian, published in 2005, and A New Order of Things, published in 1999. His most recent book, Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory, describes the history of the state-sponsored forced migration of Native Americans across the Mississippi River in the 1830s and the theft of their land. Though Sant understands these events are often referred to as, quote, forced migration, he is precise in his argument that what was involved in the theft of land was the deportation, expulsion, and extermination of peoples in acts that were, again, state-sponsored. Sant shows how politics and economics of white supremacy lay at the heart of the expulsion of Native Americans, how corruption, greed, and administrative indifference and incompetence contributed to the disaster of its implementation, and how the consequences resonate, and not only in the South. Here's Colette LaBeouf talking with Claudio Sant.
I'm so glad to talk to you today about Unworthy Republic. And starting with the introduction, where you talk about sort of how this book came about for you as a scholar, and an actual personal connection to beginning the book. Can you talk about that experience?
So Indian removal, as we commonly call it, it's one of the most familiar subjects in Native American history. And for that reason, I think I had stayed away from it as a scholar. Of course, I teach it every year to my students. But I didn't really think about delving into this as a scholar until I inherited a cache of letters that had belonged to my grandfather. And he escaped from Hungary in 1938 and continued corresponding with his family, with his parents and siblings, through 1943. Hungarian Jews were among the last to be deported to Auschwitz in the spring of 1944. So it's this extraordinary run of correspondence describing what it was like to live under these terribly oppressive conditions in Hungary in the early 1940s. The correspondence is all in Hungarian. I had it translated and read through it, and then started reading more broadly about the history of deportations in the 20th century and stretching back into the 19th century. And that in turn got me thinking about the deportation that occurred much closer to my current home in Athens, Georgia. And that, of course, was the deportation of Indigenous Americans in the 1830s.
Also in the introduction, you talk about this phrase you just began with, Indian removal, which is a familiar phrase. And you talk about how it's inappropriate and incomplete. And you choose other words. Can you talk about those other words and why you went with those in the book?
We all know this event familiarly as Indian removal, and historians still use the term today. It predominates everywhere. But in fact, as best as I could tell, digging into the sources, this was a term that was coined and favored by proponents of the policy. And the opponents most commonly called it an expulsion. There were some foreign observers who called it a deportation. As one of the opponents noted, actually on the floor of the House in 1830, Indian removal is a soft word, he said. He suggested it didn't capture the violence that lay behind this state-sponsored deportation. So I don't use the term in the book. I refer to it in several different ways. I call it an expulsion, and as I said, that's historically appropriate in that the opponents most often call it an expulsion. I also call it a deportation. I think that's a useful word because although these were sovereign nations, and usually, you know, we can't say that the United States, the United States cannot deport Mexicans from Mexico. Despite this fact, I think it's a useful term because it gets at the fact that the United States was infringing and violating indigenous sovereignty in the 1830s. In other words, they were really ignoring it and acting as if federal U.S. sovereignty extended fully over indigenous Americans. I also use the word extermination, and again, that's historically accurate because there were high-level military officers who said explicitly that the Secretary of War was going for extermination, at least in the case of the Seminole people in Florida.
So you are talking about where you live. You're talking about Georgia in some of the book, but you're talking about a number of indigenous peoples. And can you talk about who those peoples are?
Yeah, we usually conflate, I think we conflate Indian removal with the Trail of Tears and with the Cherokees. And that is a central part of the story for several different reasons. But they did represent only a fraction of the 80,000 people who were deported. They represented about 15,000 of those 80,000. So the vast majority of the people who were deported were indeed in the South, and that includes the Cherokees and the Seminoles, the Chickasaws, Creeks, and Choctaws. So these are, you know, what are sometimes called the five civilized tribes or the five tribes. They also had a vast land base in the 1830s. So they owned about a third of what later became the state of Alabama and fully half of present-day Mississippi and a northern fraction of Georgia and then part of Florida. It's with some of the most valuable agricultural lands in the entire world at the time. So that's the bulk of the people who are deported. But also, if you look at this nationally, there are thousands of individuals and families living in what historians call the Old Northwest, what was called the Old Northwest, in Indiana and Ohio and elsewhere. So it really is a national undertaking.
One of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading is, first of all, the research and the narrative is so complex in terms of the layers of federal efforts, but also local responses, and then the indigenous themselves, their self-governing. But one of the things that was so interesting to me as I was reading is the difference between the perception of the indigenous peoples as it drove policy. So the perceptions of that they were incapable of day-to-day life, or that their lifestyles were not appropriate. How does that story work in the 1830s?
So if we look at the at U.S. citizens in the 1830s, I think we could divide them into a couple different groups. The vast majority of U.S. citizens lived between, really in the Northeast, between Boston and Philadelphia. Most of those individuals did not have any firsthand experiences with Native Americans. But there is this smaller group that is living, some of these people live out in Ohio or Indiana or Mississippi and Alabama, and they encounter Native peoples on a daily basis. But what's interesting about this is that there are some very cynical political operatives in the 1830s who are writing articles directed at readers in the Northeast. This is the seat of power politically and demographically. And these articles are really misrepresenting who Native peoples are. And the writers of these articles they know what they're saying is not really accurate. So in the 1830s, there really is a tremendous diversity. If you look at Indigenous Americans, there are indeed people who survive mostly on hunting with a little bit of farming, but there are other people who farm in the same way as white Americans did in the 1830s, and they dress in the same way. And in fact, there are observers who say, well, they dress better than the white people who are their neighbors. They speak English. Some of them were Christian. But when this is presented to the American public as a whole, Indigenous Americans are said to be savage and backwards and primitive. And it's said that it's impossible for them to survive within the boundaries of the United States. Now, Indigenous Americans pushed back. And they said, this is a morass of lies and misrepresentations. And they were frustrated that it was difficult for them to get their message out. They did everything they could. They went on speaking tours in the Northeast. The Cherokees launched their own newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix, and they had some success that way, actually. But at the end of the day, they remained frustrated and disappointed that there were so many misrepresentations mm-hmm. circulating in mm-hmm. the United States.
One of the things that also gets discussed as the expulsion, as you talk about the expulsion taking place, is, of course, the fatalities, the disease, that it becomes extermination in the process, and the violence inherent in that. Was that part of the policy?
Well, I think to answer that question, we have to step back and just kind of look at what the federal government was in 1830. It had, I think, approximately 11,000 employees in the entire federal government. And the vast majority of those people worked for the post office. So they delivered mail. They were not going to be helpful in moving families.
Right.
And the government had no experience moving so many thousands of people. They had moved troops around and they had fed them, they had provisioned them, but troops are trained and troops don't include infants and elderly and sick mm-hmm. people and pregnant women. So this was an entirely different, novel undertaking to try to move 80,000 families
from their homes.
From their homes to transport them hundreds, sometimes close to 1,000 miles westwards over lands that were uncharted, where there were no roads, to provision, to feed them. I mean, it was pure hubris for them to think that they could do this competently. And indeed, they could not. So that's part of the story. But the other part of the story is that not only are they overwhelmed logistically, but they don't, at the end of the day, for the most part, they don't care. As this operation unfolds, it turns out to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. There are so many stories that they tell in the book of families being stranded on the banks of, say, the Arkansas River, just west of the Mississippi River, in the middle of the winter with no tents and just a little bit of clothing, no shoes, no food for weeks on end. Mm-hmm. The people who are hired to provision these migrants, these dispossessed families, they don't care if the food they delivered isn't short measure or if the supplies are rotting. There's just a lot of bad faith and ill will, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm.
That was Claudio Sant talking with Colette LaBeouf. Let's take a break. When we come back, more from Sant, and then we'll hear from Jack and Jasmine on a new documentary about M.C. Escher. But first, here's some music. Earth Surface People is a collective from Arizona, and members are based in both Arizona and New Mexico. Here's Running with Fire from their album Juniper. Stay with us.
Running with fire, the animal mind wandering off away. Summer ain't ripe, the faces are all too gray. Flawed by design. running with fire.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. We're listening to Colette Leboeuf in conversation with Claudio Sant. Sant's book, Unworthy Republics, subtitled The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory, portrays the history of the forced migration of Native Americans across the Mississippi River in the 1830s and the state-sponsored theft of their lands. Drawing on first-hand accounts and the lengthy records produced by the federal government, Sant's deeply researched book argues that Indian removal, as advocates of the policy called it, was not an inevitable chapter in U.S. expansion. Rather, it was a fiercely contested political act designed to secure new lands for the expansion of slavery and to consolidate the power of the southern states. Indigenous peoples fought relentlessly against the policy, while many U.S. citizens insisted that it was a betrayal of the nation's values. When Congress passed the act by a razor-thin margin, it authorized one of the first state-sponsored mass deportations in the modern era, marking a turning point for Native peoples and for the United States. Here's Claudio Sant talking with Colette Leboeuf.
Toward the end of the book, you talk about, you know, why did this happen? You know, why did this happen at this time? And you talk about profit, you talk about white supremacy, you talk about the power of the South as well. What is the central reason that this happened?
So I mentioned earlier that these are some of the most viable agricultural lands in the entire world. And this is because of this arc of fertile soil that stretches across the heart of what is today Alabama and Mississippi, but what was then the Creek, Choctaw, and Chickasaw Nations. It's the what we call the Black Belt, named after the color of the soil, and it's ideal for growing cotton. And cotton was the most valuable export in the United States at the time, and so planters especially in my home state of Georgia, looked westwards and they envisioned creating this slave empire. They made no apologies about it. They were proud of this. They thought that this empire of slave plantations would move westwards into Alabama and Mississippi, and then eventually to the shores of the Pacific. And they even saw it crossing the border down into Mexico and then into the Caribbean. They envisioned taking Cuba. They thought that they would dominate not just the Union, not just the United States, but also the entire world. So, you know, this was step one, was to get rid of indigenous Americans and to take their land. And I think that's really, really sits right at the heart of this story. But a related part of this, one thing I discovered in the course of writing a book is that Northeastern financiers were deeply invested, literally and figuratively, in what was going on in the South. So as soon as this became federal policy with the passage of the Indian Removal Act in May of 1830, they formed the leading financiers in Wall Street and in Boston and Philadelphia to form these joint stock companies. And these were dedicated, they pulled their capital and then invested in dispossessing Native Americans in Alabama and Mississippi. And in fact, this network, this stream of capital crossed the Atlantic. There were investors and financiers in England who were also putting their capital into this undertaking. And there's some evidence that it also stretched to continental Europe as well.
So it's an economic story.
It is. And we often think of it as largely a kind of military and political undertaking. And we think of it as a Southern undertaking. And it was in so many ways. But it did have this Northern component and international component. And yes, economics and finance are right at the center.
Right. You're also you're a professor of history. Do you teach this period to your students?
I do teach it. I feel like in Georgia, students know when they come into college, they know that Georgia played an important role in the removal of the Cherokees. They don't grasp the extent of it and how central this event was to the rise of the United States. So if we look at the economy in the mid-19th century, a huge proportion of cotton that was grown and exported was grown on lands that had only a couple years earlier been indigenous. They were farmed. They were small family farms. Choctaw and Creek farmers, and almost overnight, these lands were cleared and turned into sprawling cotton plantations. So there's that side of the story, but there's also the related expansion of slavery into this region. So the Civil War breaks out in 1861. Only 25 years earlier, the heart of the Confederacy, Alabama and Mississippi, was Indian country. So, and we think of the antebellum South, we have these visions of sprawling slave plantations, but that existed for only a couple of decades in Alabama and Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So I don't think students grasp that. I don't think it's really well taught at the level of high school. I also think that they come into college with a sense of the kind of inevitability of this event. And that's one thing that I push back against in the book. It was really a political act. It passed by a mere 5 votes in Congress. This is out of 199 that were cast in the House of Representatives. It was the most controversial issue to come before the Republic to that point. And it generated a massive petition campaign. There were hundreds and hundreds of petitions signed by thousands of Americans saying that this would be a violation of the foundational principles of the American Republic if Indigenous Americans were deported. So it really was a political decision. And when you say that, I don't want to suggest, I don't want to sound naive and suggest that, oh, well, they could have retained all of their lands and stayed within the boundaries in their traditional homelands. That was implausible. But Native Americans did envision a future living within the Republic, and they recognized that these were unfair political conditions and times in which they were living, but they understood that it was possible to compromise, to cede some lands in order to retain others within their traditional homelands. Unfortunately, that became impossible with the passage of the Indian Removal Act.
Well, I'm curious about what you're working on now.
So I am finishing up a digital humanities project that's been going on for far too long. But this is a project to map the indigenous African and European populations north of the Rio Grande, decade by decade, between 1500 and 1800. This demographic transformation that occurs north of the Rio Grande, it's really one of the central events creating the world that we now live in. Mm-hmm. But we have no way of envisioning it. Mm-hmm. There is no such map. And there are some very good reasons. It's almost impossible to make one. We've been working, I have been partnering with a number of individuals. So we've been working on this for many years. And hopefully in 2 months, you will be able to go to ehistory.org and to watch this demographic transformation unfold decade by decade. You can draw a polygon on the map and return what the population count was and see how it changed over time. So
that sounds amazing. I can understand why it's taken a long time.
It's taken far too long.
It needs to wrap up. I understand. Well, that's great. Claudio, thank you so much for talking with me. And I really felt like as I was reading the book, it's so important. And, you know, here in New Mexico, where we are, also such an important history to understand, a piece of American history that relates specifically to indigenous peoples.
Well, thank you.
That was Claudio Sant talking with Colette LaBeouf. Northern New Mexico listeners, and even those streaming from elsewhere in the country, can go to Claudio Sant's website to get a feel for virtual history projects that tell this history of loss, violence, and policy. If you go to claudiosant.com and navigate to digital projects, you'll find the virtual project called Invasion of America, which is an interactive map along with a short video that illustrates with clarity how, between 1776 and 1887, the United States seized over 1.5 billion acres of land from America's indigenous people by treaty and executive order. If you're interested in a particular location or region, you can read here and see documents that tell the story of land cession across the continent. Let's take a short break with more music from Earth Surface People. And when we come back, Jasmine Freedom and Jack Lorraine talk about what they liked and what they didn't like about M.C. Escher, Journey to Infinity, a new documentary that comes out on February 5th.
From a small town, watching the weeds roll on by. You made your lines like public housing, save up your silver all your life. Will you wait for the time? Will you wait for her smile? Thank you.
was Jesus Town by Earth Surface People. You're listening to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. As we all know, movie theaters and performance venues in New Mexico have been shut down since March of last year. But guess what? At the TCA, we've still been watching movies. Yes, online, but movies nonetheless from the world of independent cinema. The TCA Film Committee has been curating selections. One movie coming up is about the artist M.C. Escher. Here's Jack Lorraine and Jasmine Freedom.
Do you want to introduce the movie?
Yeah. I mean, we decided to watch this movie, M.C. Escher, Into Infinity. You know, now we're going to talk about it. Something I noticed right away about the Escher movie is that it was sort of filmed as if the viewer is in the point of view of Escher himself. A lot of the scenes were like that, which I found a little disorienting at first.
Yeah, I think it was a little clumsy. You did mention two things that I really liked about the movie, which were that they used his own material to guide the film. I thought the voice choice was a little much. It was Stephen Fry, who's great, but I felt like he was very boisterous, and it didn't always match up with the tone of what I felt like Escher was saying in his letters and in his diaries. And the other piece that you mentioned is the animation. I loved how they did that. I thought that was one of the best things about the movie. There was a moment where Escher was talking about the future of animation, and I think when he was writing it, the only big steps that had been taken in animation were Snow White and, you know, maybe a few other early Disney movies. I love cartoons and I love animation, and I wished that he had gone more into his thoughts about the future of animation, and it made me kind of wish he had been alive to see more.
He talked about what he thought of the animation of the day. He said he wasn't a big fan of the early Disney. You know, he said he respected them, but he thought there was so much more that could be done with the art of the animated film. I enjoyed the special effects that they used to kind of take his paintings and, you know, bring them to life.
Yeah, that was really cool. What did you think about towards the end, a part where they colorized some of his images?
I thought that was interesting, and especially what the voiceover, Stephen Fry's voice claiming to be Escher, which by that point in the movie we kind of get used to, oh, this is Escher just talking to us. But he was saying that the hippies in the U.S. in the 60s were taking his prints and adding color and not subtle color either, like day glow or blacklight type. You know,
yeah, they think made he posters. Described it as like grotesque or garish, something like that.
Yeah, he said it was hideous or something. he was offended by the fact that they took his black and white prints and put all this grotesque color to it. And this is something that I learned from the movie, is that he was very opposed to seeing that happen with his artwork.
I think that raises a really interesting point about how Escher saw himself in that part where they were showing like the colorized art of his. I think he said something along the lines of like his art being really sober and somber. And it is interesting in comparison to, yeah, this pop culture of Escher that we have as being really like psychedelic or really out there, to know that he thought of it as, you know, really careful and calculated. And I think that that was something that came out a lot throughout the movie.
That was Jack Lorraine and Jasmine Freedom. Let's take a break. And when we come back, their conversation continues about M.C. Escher and the new documentary coming out this month about his life and work. Stay with us.
Killing me straight, I'd lie. If you weren't holding me down, I watch bashful and happy. Well, I see you dancing like a fool now, heart, soul, the sinful divine, all the cosmos watch as we cross this line and die, and I, my, I call it luck, she calls it fate, like the I'm
Welcome back. I'm Chelsea. You're listening to TCA Radio Hour on KNCE 93.5 FM. We're listening to Jack Lorraine and Jasmine Freedom talk about M.C. Escher. A new documentary comes out this week about his life and work. The film is narrated by Stephen Fry, and dialogue is based on diary musings, excerpts from lectures, and correspondence, while Escher's woodcuts, lithographs, and other print works appear in both original and playfully altered form. Here's Jack and Jasmine continuing their conversation about the movie.
I really liked when they showed the landscapes and his images of them at the same time. It made me think about how our images of the world and landscapes can be shaped by things that we take in when we're children without really connecting them to what they are. I had seen all of these images that Escher had done of Italy. I mean, not all of them, but, you know, I'd seen them around when I was a kid without connecting them to the idea of Tuscany. And then to see them right next to each other, I mean, he wasn't getting really abstract with it. They were pretty close. And it was interesting to me how we grow into a sense of what the world looks like and what fantasy or abstraction looks like, and then a situation where those things aren't necessarily like as far apart as you think they are was really interesting to me.
Yeah, that also reminds me of, I think we maybe had talked about it earlier, when he visited Spain and the Alhambra and was exposed to all that sort of Arabic architecture, and after seeing the movie, I think came to realize that was where he started to pick up on the idea of tessellations, and his artwork got a lot more geometrical. And, you know, I think it's clear after seeing the movie that came from the sort of Arab influence.
Definitely, as you were saying that, I was thinking that's really when he becomes the Escher that we think of as Escher, is when he starts exploring those tessellations after that. I think it is interesting, too, that he, like, insisted on using pictures. I mean, not just, like, mathematical shapes. He says something, you know, really specifically about that these are just geometric shapes and it's kind of a pity. He was so mathematical himself, in a way, and yet he kind of pushes away from mathematics in that aspect of, like, always wanting to use an image that connects somehow to animals and things that are in the real world and aren't just abstracted shapes.
Like the birds, the intertwining black and white birds are so much like some of the sort of tile work at the Alhambra, but the tile work isn't birds, it's just shapes. And granted, his birds aren't really like very naturalistic looking, you know, birds of nature. They're
right. They're kind of somewhere between an image of a bird and a geometric shape.
Yeah. Well, which reminds me also of a book that I have been reading for almost a year now, a dense work called Gödel, Escher, Bach, I think, by Douglas Hofstadter. I think the subtitle of the book is The Eternal Golden Braid. He takes these three artists, scientists, philosophers, and shows through their work some of the limits of logical reasoning. And the movie kind of touched on that a little bit, but I think maybe we talked earlier about they could have done more with that aspect of his work.
To me, that was one of the most interesting things about the movie, was that interplay of art and mathematics. I really wish I had written this quote down, but there's something that he says about, like, not being, I don't know, enough of an artist to really be, like, fit in the art world, or somehow not fitting in, and yet being not seriously interested enough in mathematics to be a mathematician, and so just kind of, like, floating between the worlds of art and science.
One of the interesting things that the movie brought out was the degree to which he was frustrated by that unique position, because he didn't feel respected by the fine art world, and he certainly didn't feel like he had anything to offer the mathematical, you know, or science world, but yet he was really drawn to bring them together in this way, and which we appreciate now, but it sounds like he was frustrated because it wasn't really appreciated in his day, except by the hippies.
Yeah, I think, so your book sounds a little bit more interesting than the book that I'm about to mention, but it's Chaos by James Glick, and it gives a history of the field of, like, chaos theory and fractal mathematics, but in particular, him saying that thing about feeling kind of isolated in that role between math and art really was, like, so poignant to me, because it seems from my reading, that's how most people who latched on to some aspect of this like field of mathematics that hadn't quite opened up yet felt when they were doing it. A fractal is something like that packs so much into a certain space by following like certain rules, you know, like self-similarity, like a tree branch that diverts in the same way that it started again and again. It takes these rules and it packs so much information or so much stuff into the smallest amount of space that something like a line can end up being, instead of one-dimensional, having a dimension of something like 1.26. I'm thinking of what's called like the Koch curve, and it looks like a snowflake. That Escher could latch onto this through just kind of an artistic exploration of the mathematics that were used in like the Alhambra and stuff was so cool to me that he was, I mean, like less than a lifetime away from, you know, having companions in all of the stuff that he was exploring. I don't think he was the only one that had explored like this type of mathematics, and it's even in conjunction with art before, but it's definitely somebody who did it in a really like distinct visual way that's easy for a lot of people to latch onto, I think.
I think what you were saying makes me realize that since Escher's time, the world of art, but also the world of science and mathematics, basically the world in general, has just become increasingly complex, just like an Escher painting. You know, I think towards the end of the film, they show, almost a mandala with a simple image in the middle, and it's sort of fractalized and repeated towards the edges of the circle, and it becomes increasingly smaller and more complex. And I think, you know, that's just what's happening with humanity and with, you know, I think that's what happens with the natural world in terms of evolution, although, you know, humans, you know, on Earth has started to stunt that.
Yeah, I think the idea of complexity is really interesting because, like, I'm not a mathematician, so like it's kind of like a, you know, like a, when they say like pop psychology, it's like a pop mathematician interest in it. But I do think that the main thing that stands out to me is that it really explores in a formal way how things can get increasingly complex and also incorporate simplicity. So this thing that you're saying about like this growing complexity is super true, but then there's also something about it that's kind of simple too. And also that this idea that he brings up in the same, I think, moment that he was talking about exploring like the infinite on a finite plane, he also talks about an image that has a beginning but no end, like that it gets infinitely complex. And that's the kind of image that's produced by like computerized explorations.
I think the movie, you know, brought that aspect of his work out a little bit. It could have been more. Actually, having watched it a second time, I realized that the scenery of Tuscany and Spain was really nice. When I wasn't taking notes and I was just like observing the movie, I was like, oh, that looks so nice. I would like to be there.
But yeah, I mean, nice to get a glimpse of vacation where you can these days.
And that's how he looked at it. I think part of it was the voiceover of his writings about, you know, being in when he was in Switzerland, he just wasn't happy in the wintertime. He wanted to be by the ocean and you know, in the warm weather.
When I was watching it, it made me think of like the first image of Escher that I remember seeing. And I was curious if there was like a distinct first impression of Escher that you had, if you remember like the first time that you saw some of his work or what piece it was.
Yeah, definitely. I think the first thing that comes to mind is the stairs. I know he's got a few different pieces that have the sort of eternal staircase.
Yeah, I asked my husband the same question, and I feel like I'm getting a little bit of this from your answer. It's almost hard to pin down because his art did become so popular that imagery was everywhere. But I guess for me, it like every time I see, I don't know what it's called, but this one with like the fish and the birds and there's kind of like a gradient. My mom had it on like a white t-shirt when I was a kid. And every time I look at it, I think about basketball. I think she must have worn it when she was playing basketball a lot.
That's a great story. And I think it just goes to show that, like, Escher has really become a household name, you know, for us in, you know, this culture.
It can be easy to just, like, brush off an artist whose work you see all the time. But I felt like this was a nice chance to explore how he actually considered his own work and what the feeling was that went into it. And that was really cool.
That was Jack Lorraine and Jasmine Freedom. MC Escher comes out this Friday. And hey, if you want to watch a movie and then discuss it on the radio, we invite anyone who might be interested to participate. What do you get out of it? Well, a chance to watch a new independent cinema release for free and the chance to have a conversation about it, which I guess is not much, but it seems like Jack and Jasmine had a nice exchange and maybe you will too. So reach out to us by email at info@tcatouse.org or give us a call. We're always happy to hear from you. Next up, Elise Morion brings us some news from the art world. Take it away, Elise.
As 2021 gets on its way, filmmakers, movie enthusiasts, and the entire film industry around the world are watching with acute attention the films that have been released over the past 12 months. On April 25th, the Academy of Motion Picture Art and Science, also known as the Oscars, will hold its ceremony. Movies can be nominated for Oscars if they have been released between the 1st of January 2020 and February 28th of 2021. This is why we are seeing releases now, as the distributors are following the rules to be part of the competition. A much-talked-about movie, to be released on February 19th, just in time for the Oscars, is Nomadland, a movie directed by Chloe Zhao and starring Frances McDormand.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom said that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
No.
Nominations for the Oscars will be announced on March 25th. So far, predictions have been ranging from Borat's subsequent movie film, a mock documentary, to Time, a true love story and documentary about a woman fighting for the release of her husband from a 60-year prison sentence, or Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which portrays a teenager going to New York as she faces an undesired pregnancy and lack of local support in her state of Pennsylvania. The Academy is not the only organization to recognize and acclaim movies. The Golden Globes, another institution in the world of film and television, will hold its ceremony at the end of this month, on the 28th of February. Lately, its eligibility criteria for the Best Picture Award have renewed a long-lasting conversation.
Well, now to our GMA cover story. The movie Minari is up for Golden Globes consideration in the Best Foreign Language Film category, while critics of the decision question if the rules for Best Picture need to be changed. Take a look.
Minari is a movie about an immigrating Korean family who settles in Arkansas. While the movie is an American production, most of the dialogue is in Korean, which makes the movie ineligible to run for the Golden Globe Best Picture.
What a wonderful day to be in the house of the Lord. If you're here with us for the first time, please stand. What a beautiful family. Glad you're here.
After Minari's success at Sundance Festival last year, its ineligibility has brought attention to the rules of the Golden Globe Academy. And it's not the first time this problem has arisen. Roma in 2018 and Parasite in 2019 have faced the same issue. Since the dialogue in both of these movies was less than 50% in English, neither could run for the Best Picture at the Golden Globes. But this time, in the case of the film Minari, the movie has been made solely in the United States. The current criteria and their limitations contribute to a conversation about representing the United States in movies, arts, and media in general. According to the Center for Immigration Studies, in 2018, 67 million residents in the United States spoke a different language than English at home. That's to say, more than 20% of people living in the U.S. do not primarily speak English. It seems like a change needs to happen so that art that portrays such a large part of our communities can be recognized and valued as American. The Golden Globe rules won't change for 2021, and a movie made in the United States with an American director, Lee Isaac Chung, and American actors will run for the Foreign Language Award. While it deprives the movie from a potential Golden Globe's Best Picture, it brought a lot of attention to the film, and this attention might not be in vain, as Minari's reviews are outstanding and the movie is well eligible for the Oscars Best Picture Award.
Pretty boy, pretty boy.
I'm not pretty, I'm good looking.
That's it for your art news. I'm Anis Moyo. More in the next radio hour. And before then, enjoy these movies.
This brings us to the end of the hour. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been Tau Center for the Arts Radio Hour, brought to you with generous support from this station, KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetausradio.com, and our local business partner, The Burns Group. The music we heard this hour comes from Earth Surface People, a music collective that includes Jai Ram Rideout on saxophone, Dakota Yazzie on vocals, guitar, and bass, Daniel Brenner on the drums, Alan Gonzalez on the djembe, and Zach Dominguez on keyboard. Shout out to Earth Surface People. Thank you so much for sharing your music. We'll leave you with Verde Bayou from their 2019 album, Juniper.